First thing he sees is the Valley of Elah. And you go, well, what's that? That's where a young teenager by the name of David ran, crying to the top of his voice, "You come to me with a sword and a spear, but I come to you in the name of Jehovah." And he slew Goliath right where he lives. That's a great place to live. Wouldn't that be a great place to sit on your back porch and look every morning? Somebody say yes. Oh, my goodness. And I'm so glad to have him. First, I'm going to ask Gil if you'll come up just a minute. Now, then I'll ask Dr. Nunley, you can come with him, too, because you're going to be here. We're working through this because Gil does not speak a word of English. And so I'm going to interpret for him. Just a minute. Go ahead. If you're hot, go ahead and say something. I know you understand it, but...
לדבר עכשיו? לדבר?
Yeah.
איזה כיף לבוא מולכם היום, איזה הזדמנות לבוא ולדבר מולכם. אני כל כך שמח להיות פה בברנסון, ברנסון? אני כל כך שמח להיות פה היום, וזאת הזדמנות שחיכיתי לה כל חיי, ותודה רבה לכולם על ההזדמנות.
Gil said, I'm extremely happy to be here tonight. From the very time I... From the moment I walked into the house, I felt the love of God. We share the same God, and we're going to see what God shows us this evening. Now, I know you've been really working on English. Is there a few words you'd like to try to say in English?
Sure.
Yeah.
I didn't know I had to do this in English.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Well, it's a miracle.
Okay, well, let me upload the system. Okay, I'll upload. Okay, I'm done. I'm ready. That's it.
Oh, this is great.
Okay.
He likes the Yankees, too. I don't. So, you know. I'm so glad that this is a great man of God, and I love you. I love you already, and we're brothers, and I'm so happy for my brother that has been a brother of mine for over 35 years, probably, our dear friend, Dr. Wave Nunley, and what a privilege to have you here with us this evening. And so I'm going to turn this over. Yes, amen. I'm going to turn this over to Dr. Nunley and to Gil, and we'll see what God has for us. Did we get that set up? Oh, my. Amber?
Let me just tell you. You
pulled not a rabbit. You pulled an elephant out of a hat because we didn't have the ability to see all this, but she got her done. Thank you very, very much. All yours, Doctor.
Blessings, Pastor Sam.
Rabbi?
Thank you for having us, the whole crew. Lacey, Jason, Abby, grandkids, and my special friend, Gil. It's good to be back in Branson. You guys are one of two whole churches. Can you count that high? Two whole churches that Gil has had the privilege of speaking to in the United States. The other one is as far away as Fort Myers, Florida. So we've come to Branson. And we've come to Sanctuary of Hope in order to give a message of hope in a time that is really difficult. And Gil's going to share more about that. But I just wanted to let you know that Gil has taken time away from his family, from his children, from his two pet rabbits and one dog, and from the IDF, where he has been first patrolling around the area of his moshav, Neis Harim, and more recently, from the area right around Bethlehem, trying to keep those people and those places that we all hold dear safe and accessible too. Because at some point, God's going to push back the sea again, and we're going to have the opportunity to study the Bible where it actually happened, and you guys are going to get to be a part of that. How cool is that going to be, right? So I want you guys to join me in giving a good redneck Ozarkian welcome to Gil Reggae.
Tear it up, buddy.
Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. Wow, it's such an honor being here before you. In fact, I'm recapping now what I just did in Hebrew. And Pastor Sam, by the way, you translated beautifully, 100%. Okay? So you can get your Hebrew graduation certificate from Dr. Wave Nunley. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, thank you for welcoming here this wonderful evening. During my visit to the United States over the past 2 weeks, I've encountered so much love for Israel. You guys are the very best. I can already see that. And so what we're going to do today is not just to increase that love because between Israelis and Americans, between Jews and Christians, but we're also going to give everybody hope. Our goal tonight is to instill hope in everybody because only 6 months ago, the situation seemed very hopeless. Now we're going to grow stronger out of this situation, and we're going to be soon stronger than how we were on October 6th. Ladies and gentlemen, allow me first to talk about, to present myself. I grew up, I'm Gil Weger, I'm 46 years old. I am married to Inbar, my beloved wife, and we have four daughters, age 4 to 13. We also have a female dog and two female rabbits. So I'm outnumbered 1 to 8. Therefore, whenever I'm home, I don't get to talk much. Hence, I will be overcompensating on you guys tonight. I hope you don't mind. And so, we're going to start. I'm going to present myself first. I grew up in a small community, somewhere between Tel Aviv and Haifa, along Israel's coastline. That community is where my parents, my grandparents used to live, where my brother and his family, uncles, cousins still live even today. I grew up, and then I joined the IDF when I was 18 years old. Is there anyone here who has ever served in the United States Army? Please raise your hand. Okay, very good. Very good. In Israel, guys, it's mandatory. Men have to serve for 3 years, women have to serve for 2 years. It's the only country worldwide where women must serve in the army. And so I ended up serving for 4 years because I became a tank officer, and as an officer, I had to do an extra year. After 4 years, I was released, and I actually went to South America backpacking for 2 years, and I learned some Spanish, which proved itself useful in Florida, if you remember. And then I went uphill to Jerusalem to study at the Hebrew University on Mount Scopus, next to the Mount of Olives, right there. And I have the professor speaking at me, showing me law on the screen, but out the window I see the Dome of the Rock. So I was prone to graduate from my studies, to do the internship, the bar exam, master's degree in international law, and gave all of the above to my Jewish mother so she can hang it on the wall and frame it real nice and show off to her Jewish friends that her son is a lawyer while he's happy that he does absolutely nothing with it. And so I prefer the window over the screen, and I became a tour guide. That's how I got to meet my dear friend, Dr. Wave Nunnally, and his amazing wife, Lacey, and their amazing family who is with us here today. And then I was a tour guide, and I was guiding people from all over the world, and I was a very busy tour guide until October 7, 2023. That was the last day of a full month of Jewish holidays. You know, we have the month of Tishrei is when we have 4 different Jewish holidays. The first is Rosh Hashanah. Then we have Yom Kippur. Then we have Sukkot. And the last one is the day in which the war broke out. That day is Simchat Torah, in which we finish and start over the annual reading cycle of the Bible. That day have happened to be October 7, 2023. And it was on that day that I slept in the Sukkah, the improvised wooden huts that Jews are building for the Feast of Sukkot, with my 2 little daughters. The older ones, they have their cell phone, they have a life of their own. The little ones are still cute, so they wanted to sleep with me in the Sukkah. So like, Daddy, can we do it one last night before we have to unpack all of this, you know, and put it back in the warehouse? I said, sure, of course. I was hoping that they will cut me some slack and we'll be waking up, not before 8 or 9 a.m., but lo and behold, 6:30 a.m., I wake up to the sound of explosions. I see, looking towards Gaza, and in fact, the place where David defeated Goliath is between where I am and where Gaza is. So I'm looking in that direction, and I see rockets intercepting other rockets up in the air. Iron Dome missiles intercepting Hamas rockets up in the air. 4,000 rockets were fired at Israel from the Gaza Strip on one day. What we didn't know at the beginning is that they were all just a decoy, the cover-up for 3,500 terrorist attack against Israel. People who were trained, brewed, and indoctrinated to kill Jews and to attack Israel at any given moment. When the warning was given to them that they need to be ready at 6:30 a.m. That's October 7th, 2023, to attack Israel, they already had all the indoctrination in their head. And they were now invading Israel, dynamiting the wall in 22 different locations, penetrating the Jewish state and attacking communities along the Gaza border area. They were blasting the wall in 22 different locations. And what they ended up doing was not even close to what they planned on doing. They had goals far more reaching than what they ended up doing. They wanted to get almost as far as Tel Aviv, almost as far as Jerusalem. They wanted to sprint to the West Bank to make the Palestinians in the West Bank rise against Israel as well. They wanted to capture naval bases, army bases, intelligence bases, air force bases, and to take a picture in the cockpit of an F-16 fighter jet. Guys, they've had way more far-reaching objectives, goals, than what they ended up achieving. We stopped them, but it took a heavy toll on us. 1,400 people have died, were massacred that day. Many of them were tortured before they were shot in the head. Many of them were raped, gang raped, beheaded, put into microwaves and ovens, and were tortured in some sort of torture that reminded so many of the Holocaust. This situation was the worst catastrophe in Israel's history, and we couldn't go quiet about that. No. We got our act together. And when October 7th was over, half the terrorists who invaded Israel that day were already dead. But so were 1,400 Israelis, most of whom were civilians. 250 of them were captured and were taken hostages to the Gaza Strip. 134 of them are still there, including 16 women under the age of 40. 6 months have passed. And if they are not coming back in 3 months, they could come back in a different situation than how they were captured. And therefore, it's really important that we do the very best we can to bring the hostages back. Guys, I was a very busy tour guide on October 7th. All of my groups were canceled, and I had to reorganize my life as well. Eventually, at 46 years of age, I never imagined I would be wearing uniform once again. And so I was called up to guard the very community where I was living. And I spent the whole month of December. They gave you an M16, two magazines, 58 bullets, and wished you good luck. At the end of December, they took the machine gun, they took the magazines, the bullets, told me to keep the good luck and to have a trophy. I told them, take everything back, including the trophy. I'm going to find another unit. I'm going to do something meaningful with myself somewhere else. If you don't want me here and you think this is no longer dangerous, I'll go to a place still considered dangerous by you, IDF, and I will find myself a new assignment. It took me 4 weeks throughout the whole month of January to find that new assignment. And by the end of January, I found a new assignment in another community, deep inside the West Bank, in a place still considered to this day dangerous. And the name of that place happens to be Sde Boaz, which means the field of Boaz. That's the name of the community where I was serving, starting late January until March 2nd. And the only reason why I had left my comrades in arms there was to come here and not just do something meaningful in Israel, but also do something meaningful here before you lovely people. When I'm coming back to Israel at the end of this week, probably next week, and if not the week after that, I will be wearing uniform once again and would look like how I look in that picture. And I'm going to go back for 5 more weeks until they may release us, not before May 1st. So I'm going to be a soldier again, 10 days from now, let's say, give or take. And so I was very busy. During the 4 weeks in which I was between different assignments, I took 3 of my unemployed colleagues on a self-guided tour of the Gaza border area, as we did not want to experience the atrocities through any TV channel, through any media, or through anybody's bias. We wanted to experience everything firsthand, with our own eyes. So we went there, and what we saw there on a full day tour was so shocking and triggered us to do something meaningful and to let the world know of what really did happen and not what the media is telling us that kind of sort of has happened. So I'm going to show you guys now 3 slides in the next, but first, before we move to the next slide, I just want you to see the title, From the Gaza Border, a place where we saw so much hopelessness. To the field of Boaz, a place where we regain the hope. Therefore, the subtitle of this presentation is Hope for Ancient and Modern Israel, as what we are about to do is not just to talk about how we can extract hope from what happens today, despite everything, but also use the Bible as our reference point, as our main resource to extract hope from biblical events that have happened in Gaza and apply that hope on modern events happening in Israel. Are you guys willing to get more hope out of the next 45 minutes? That's what we're going to do. So our goal is to instill hope in people that despite everything, we're going to grow stronger out of this situation and we'll end up being stronger than how we were on October 6th. Let's move on to the next slide. And the next slide shows you what happened in a certain kibbutz. First, you need to know, in Hebrew, the G of English may sound sometimes as a strong A. Therefore, Gaza in English is Aza in Hebrew. Hence, a picture from a kibbutz called Kfar Aza, which is a kibbutz named after the city of Gaza. And you see here a beautiful girl called Ophir Shoshani. Ophir Shoshani was 19 years old. She was shot in the head, in her own bed, in her own house, in her own community. So how many hundreds were shot in similar fashion? Some were tortured, and many bad things have happened to them before they were actually murdered. Why did I pick that picture? Because you see here a girl, 19 years of age, a flower picked way ahead of her time. And I underscore how flower she was by the flowers that appear underneath the picture. So you can see here cyclamens, beautiful flower called in Hebrew rakefet, which underscore what kind of a flower she was that we will never get to enjoy. When we move to the next slide, I can show you guys what is called the burnt car's graveyard. 2,000 vehicles were put on fire that day by Hamas terrorists. 2,000 vehicles, most of them were actually in the Nova Peace Festival that I'm going to show you on our next slide. The Israeli forensic evidence investigators of the Israeli police have decided to take all the vehicles from all the communities that were severely hit and from the Peace Festival and from any other area around the Gaza border area and bring all of these burnt vehicles into this one place so they can find traces of DNA, blood, body organs, limbs, heads, fingers, feet, and whatever else they were able to extract so they can bring it to proper burial as Jewish law requires. What they did was to go over all of these cars and take whatever they were able to take out. Eventually, when they were done and they declared all the cars, okay, to be free of human traces and DNA, they decided to just pile them up in a pile four times bigger than what you see here at the bottom left. But in order to remind people, between 2,000 vehicles, that cars are not supposed to look like that, they decided on purpose to put a car, a regular car, unburnt, in order to remind us how a car should look like. When you look at such a volume of vehicles, you may forget how a car should actually look like. They didn't want people to forget about it. Over time, the burnt car's memorial started having, quote-unquote, life of its own. And they decided to bring one of the hundreds of Hamas Toyota pickup trucks, white pickup trucks that you saw on the news so many times, that on normal circumstances were supposed to accommodate four or five people. But on that day, each one of the hundreds of these pickup trucks would have 11 terrorists inside. The 11 terrorists will be equipped with AK-47 machine guns, RPGs, whatever it took for a full month stay. Remember that they had far more reaching goals than what they ended up achieving? They were planning to stay a full month. They had gas stoves. They had rice, bread, food, water, anything they needed to stay a full month. Eventually, we pushed them back and killed almost half of them only on day one, and we kept on doing it ever since. Look at the car. It even has the machine gun mount at the back. But what's most interesting about it is what its gas tank lid says. And here, if you can see it at the bottom right, it says VIP. That car enjoyed a VIP treatment by whomever allowed that car to enter the Gaza Strip to begin with. It means that that car was smuggled into the Gaza Strip, hundreds of those, and the people allowed that car to get into the Gaza Strip were receiving a VIP treatment. What can you say about that? There were more cars over there, including cars that were taken, stolen from various communities and were found in hospitals in the Gaza Strip. Later, it was proven that cows stolen from Israelis were also used to take the hostages into certain places in the Gaza Strip and later on hide them in tunnels underneath these hospitals. As we move on to the next slide, we're going to talk about the worst terrorist attack in Israel's history, the Nova Peace Festival Memorial, which on the night of October 6th have had 4,000 people attending the festival. They were dancing for the sake of peace. These were 4,000 people who came to have a good time. They came to call for peace, to dance for peace. And 1/10 of them will find their death on that day at that specific location. Into my second term in the army, back in February, like almost a month ago, I get a call from somebody from New York. And she tells me that there is someone, 23-year-old Harvard graduate, who comes to Israel on a tour and he has never been. His great uncle heard that he went to Harvard, and he may not have received in Harvard the right information regarding Israel, if you know what I mean. After what we saw over the past few months, we definitely understand that he may not got the right information, and so his uncle rushed to make sure he will have a tour guide who will show him around. Who has been to Israel before? Please raise your hand. Okay. Who wants to be in Israel? There are still a few hands that are not up in the air. Let's try this again. Who wants to be in Israel? Amazing. This is getting a lot better. Thank you for your cooperation. And so what happens is that I get a call from New York, and the uncle wants me to guide his great nephew. We have only 3 days together. If you've ever been to Israel, you know that 3 days is nothing. You can travel Israel for 300 days, even though it's only the size of New Jersey. And what happens is that we decide that of the 3 days, we will take one full day just to explore the Gaza border area. So the 23-year-old Harvard graduate will himself get to see everything firsthand with his own eyes, not through any academia in Harvard, not through the media, and not through any bias whatsoever. We go there. I didn't even have time to change my uniform. I couldn't rearrange my shifts to actually have time to change my uniform into civilian clothing. So I went there as if I'm a soldier, carrying the M16. This time they gave us something better, helmet, bulletproof vest, you name it, something a lot better. And we went there, and what he saw there really made him flip the coin over what really did happen. And each pole here in that memorial is dedicated to one of the 370 casualties who were all murdered that day just because they were dancing for the sake of peace. Can you believe that? Can you grasp that? Let me allow you to tell you what they have on them. Pictures. They have Israeli flags, wreath, and so many things added over time by family members or close friends or just people who came on a visit to see that place with their own eyes. Proportionally to 9/11, this is 5 times worse than 9/11. If you take the respective populations of Israel and the U.S., and how many died in 9/11, without underestimating their importance, and how many died here, you would have had here 14,000 dead people, 5 times worse than 9/11. This was by far Israel's worst terrorist attack ever, and we couldn't go quiet. We still cannot go quiet on this. And so what happens if you had to put all of these 370 beautiful young souls into one picture, and that's when we move on to the next slide, I'll show you a picture that I took on that February 14th right there. And I'll translate the title for you guys with your permission. Forever we shall remember you with the light and joy that went silent forever. October 7th, 2023. Guys, there was a lot more that I would have been able to show you, but I think we got the picture. This was such a blow. We were lying wounded on the floor. We were not united until October 7, 2023. Now we all got our act together. We unified our own forces. The IDF rose to the severity of the situation. And we started getting our act together and fight back. And when we move to the next slide, we'll put aside for a few moments just what happened in modern times and use ancient events to first and foremost deal with some Palestinian claims that you guys might have heard on the news, but I think you will be equipped soon with all sorts of weapons to fight these claims, and I want you to be introduced to these claims. First of all, allow me to present two Palestinian claims. One, have you ever heard the Palestinians claiming that they are descendants of the ancient Philistines? The Philistines that we hear about in the Bible? And therefore, if they are descendants of the Philistines, they are such an old nation. Let's go with the flow with that claim. Let's not try to reject it altogether. Let's go with the flow. Stay calm. Don't jump off your seat. Don't get upset. Just go with the flow and have the information to refute that claim in a few moments. The second claim is that the Philistines came to the land of Israel before the people of Israel ever made it there. So they were there before we did. Hence the title of what you see here is Who's On First? Like the famous play. Now, let's have a look at the two people in the middle and the two on the left. These four are the same. All four statues used to look like the two on the left at 1200 BC. And today, they all look like the two in the middle. You can even see the tourists down here. All four are in a place in the southern border of Egypt with Sudan. Geographically, it's no longer Egypt. Politically, nowadays, it is. And it's the statue of the one considered to be the Pharaoh of the Exodus, the one that Moses was talking face to face. His name was, most likely, Ramses II. Ramses II ruled Egypt for only 67 consecutive years, and he left 100 offsprings behind. The first 12 had died before he did. Offspring number 13 will step into his shoes. That's the one you see here to your right. And his name is Menpetah. Menpetah only ruled for 10 years, not anywhere near the longevity of his father, but he would leave behind something a lot more relevant to our story. And what he left behind is a victory inscription, because all the pharaohs were all about bragging about their own victories. They never lost any war. They only won the wars, you know. And so they show you here a victory inscription. And the victory inscription says the following. Canaan is plundered. Does the name Canaan ring the bell to you guys? Of course it does. It's the geographical name of the land of Israel, according to the first books of the Bible. Now, Canaan, therefore, mentioned here, is the geographical name of that land. Then he's giving you a checklist of cities in which he fought and where he won. All these cities bear similar names to places in today's Israel. So it's obvious that whatever he's describing there have happened in the land of Israel, according to the name of the country and to the name of these places. Then, as if it's a footnote, he's telling you that Israel has no seed. Guys, this is the first instance outside the Bible, anywhere outside the Bible, where the name Israel is mentioned. With this guy, right around the year 1210 BC, and he's saying Israel has no seed. Obviously, he got it wrong, otherwise I wouldn't be here talking to you guys here today. But never mind, we'll cut him some slack. Israel has no seed. So he's talking about seed, like the Bible does, to thy seed. He's talking about an ethnic group. Israel is an ethnic group in the land of Israel as early as 1210 BC, according to a neutral source that has no bias versus Jews or Arabs, Muslims or Jews, Israelites or Philistines, because ancient Egypt only cared about itself. They had no bias in favor of one side over the other. We know, therefore, according to a neutral source, that the people of Israel made it to the land of Israel for the first time, not after 1210 BC, which is when this guy was in power. Now, when we move to the next slide, I'll tell you what ancient Egypt says about the Philistines. And the next slide shows us another pharaoh called Ramses III. By the time Ramses II had died, after 67 years in power, everybody wanted the name Ramses to themselves. And so Ramses III was not exactly a descendant of Ramses II, but never mind. He ruled for some 20 years. And he was the ruler of Egypt, give or take, around 1130 BC. He was the one who actually left a temple behind at a place 1,000 kilometers south of Cairo called, in Egypt, Luxor. But that area is called Madinat Habu. His mortuary temple in Madinat Habu has his show-off wall right here. That's where he's bragging about his own victories. And amongst these victories, he's mentioning a double fight he had against the sea people, identified as the Philistines, who came from the area of Greece, west of Athens, where there's so much sea. And right there, they left and made it to somewhere in the Middle East. Where in the Middle East? He comes to our rescue and tells us. He's actually telling you about his maritime battle against them, in which he's defeating them. You see Semitic people winning a battle at sea against people who do not look Semitic and actually have a feather-looking helmet like the ancient Philistines were wearing. He won them at sea. What about land? Well, he gives us that detail as well. He's giving you a checklist of cities in today's Syria and tells you that the overarching name for all of that area with all of those cities is the land of the Philistines. Conclusion, by 1130 BC, 80 years after the formal slide, the Philistines are still in Syria, whereas the people of Israel have already been to the land of Israel for at least 80 years. Conclusion from the last two slides, according to a neutral source with no bias versus one side or the other, we conclude that the people of Israel have made it to the land of Israel at least 80 years before the first Philistine would ever get there. So even if the Palestinians claim to have been descendants of these Philistines, we were still in the land of Israel before they would ever get there. Keep that in mind. And this is according to a neutral source called Ancient Egypt, and I invite you guys to refute claims going all over the news worldwide, not just in the United States, that they were there first, and therefore they have the first right, and they can choose this land over ours. No, we have a neutral source that tells us that's not the case. And now we're going to move to the next slide so we can finally start touching base with the Bible. Guys, after the death of Moses, Joshua steps into his shoes. And Joshua is his chief of staff. After the death of Joshua and the conquest of most of the land of Israel of today, including 31 cities, Joshua dies. And then we no longer have one leader again behind all of us. Therefore, the next book is the book of Judges. Just the name of that book shows you how divided we were. Because we've had this tribe with its leader, that tribe with that leader, and they were fighting against regional enemies in all sorts of places, including areas of today's Jordan, like with the judge Jephthah. However, no judge out of the 12 gets so much credit like Samson. And Samson gets four chapters. I don't know of any other judge who gets so much credit to have four chapters with his content in it. Samson is the last judge of 12 who appear in the book of Judges. And he was born to a barren woman. Every time the Bible tells us that a woman is barren, we know she's going to be pregnant. It's like that also in the New Testament, the whole Bible, okay? And so Samson's mom from the tribe of Dan was barren. God decided to put himself in her womb. Sounds familiar? God decided to put himself in her womb and to make out of that womb the deliverer of the tribe of Dan to get rid of the yoke of the Philistines who were oppressing the people of Dan for some 20 years. He's also telling Samson's mom, and eventually to Samson himself, you ought to be a Nazarite. And the Nazarite vow from the book of Numbers, chapter 6, needs you to abstain from three different things. One, you are not to be in an impure situation. Number two, you are not to consume anything coming from the grape, not even the flesh of the grape, let alone drink wine. And number three, you are not to cut your hair or your beard. Samson was born to the tribe of Dan, and he was supposed to be the one delivering the tribe of Dan against the Philistines. He would start violating his roles and his vows one after another, and will become a chain accident, a train wreck, an avalanche. Samson, by the way, The words Samson and hero do not rhyme in Hebrew. However, the words Samson, failure, and catastrophe all rhyme in Hebrew. Is that a coincidence? Ask Dr. Nunnally. He will tell you how we always need to go back to Hebrew to get the real meaning of the Bible. And so Samson first starts by seeing a dead carcass. He sees honey accumulating inside. He cannot resist the temptation. He's famous for that. He reaches into the dead carcass with his hand, eats the honey. That makes him impure. Then we hear about Samson arranging a drinking festival. You're not supposed to eat grapes. You are arranging a drinking festival. You're not only violating your own vow, you're also inducing others to do the same. Not good, Samson. Samson ends up also sleeping with Philistine women. Wait a second. I thought he was supposed to fight off the Philistines, not to sleep with their women. But he sleeps with three of them. Not good, Samson. What happens is that Samson thinks that he is the John Rambo of the day. He should be getting the credit all by himself. He has valiant men, Delta Force, Navy SEALs guys in his tribe. He decides not to use them. He wants all the glory to himself. He was never told he needs to deliver his own tribe all by himself. God never wanted to micromanage Samson. He wanted to lay down the path and let Samson decide how to do it. Samson chose the wrong way of doing what God has told him to do. And eventually Samson goes to Gaza all by himself. In Judges 15, he's taking the door of the Philistine temple with the doorpost and the door joint and the whole thing out and brings it to his own tribe to get the glory to himself, not to someone else. When he comes back, the Philistines are eager to find the secret of his strength, and they bribe a woman, never mentioned as a Philistine. Her name is Delilah. She grew up not far away from where I live, and she is getting money from the Philistines to find Samson's secret. She asks him twice, "What's the secret of your strength?" He wouldn't tell her. So she tries something else, a trick that women never pulled out on men in any history, until then or ever since. What happened, Samson? Why don't you tell me your secret? Don't you love me anymore? She's actually telling him that exactly. That trick was never ever tried by women ever since. It was one in a kind situation. Okay, history never repeated itself with that. And so Samson gives in. He's revealing his secret. She puts him, she drinks, makes him drink wine. He falls asleep. She cuts off his hair. Why not cut off his finger? Why not take out an eye? Why not cut off his leg? Because by cutting the hair, she is completing on behalf of Samson his all triple violation of his Nazirite vow. He already became impure, and then he already drank wine, and eventually he loses the hair. It's his lack of belief in God that makes him lose his strength, not the fact that he doesn't have hair anymore. He's taken captive to Gaza, and when his hair starts growing out again, he actually is being brought to the temple of the Philistines in Gaza, where he uses his regenerated strength to push the walls of the temple sideways so the ceiling could cave in and he could kill upon his death more Philistines than he had in his life. Samson dies right there with all of them. And ever since then, we have a term in Hebrew, "My soul shall die with the Philistines," which is what Samson did right there. So every time an Israeli soldier has to jump on the hand grenade in order to save all of his comrades in arms all around him, he is basically doing what Samson did right over there. He is dying. His soul is dying with the Philistines, but he's saving so many other Israelites. Guys, the body of Samson is recovered by Delta Force guys from his own tribe who are going to Gaza to recover his body. And they bring him to proper burial back in his old tribal allotment, that of the tribe of Dan. What we see here is a Jewish person taken captive by the Philistines, and it boomerangs on the Philistines. Now, about 2 weeks ago, when I boarded the plane to come here, before I boarded the plane, I went to the barber, and I went to get a haircut. People told me Florida is going to be very hot, so I need a haircut. And so I'm going there, and I asked the guy, the barber, hey, man, how long would it take for an adult male to have his hair growing out again so it could be all over the place? He told me, give or take 7 to 8 months. Keep that number in mind. I'll get back to that in just a moment. And so Samson is taken captive. It boomerangs on the Philistines, and the event is framed with a specific time frame, according to my barber, of 7 to 8 months. Now, Samson dies. He is buried. And when we move to the next slide, we can actually see the very tomb of Samson. That tomb of Samson is not far away from where I happen to live. If you look at the hills in the back, I live on the back side of this mountain right here. These are the Judean hills. This is between the Philistines and where David was living in Bethlehem. Look at the tribal map. Can you see the tribal map? Can you see how many colors are on the map? Why do you think there's so many colors? Because we were divided. Each tribe to himself. So at the end of the book of Judges, the people of Israel are so divided as they were on October 6, 2023. And if you look clearly, you can see the tribe of Dan right here. And the Philistines were down in that yellow area. To this day, this is the greater Tel Aviv area. How do you call the greater Tel Aviv area in Israel nowadays? 3,200 years after Samson, the Dan metropolitan area. But Samson's failure makes his own tribe relocate itself to the furthest place possible from the Philistines, Israel's northernmost border. Hence, we have in Israel two different areas called Dan. One really big, the original whereabouts of the tribe of Dan, the only big metropolitan area of today's Israel, Tel Aviv, whereas the other one is in the far northern end, a place that today you cannot even access because of Hezbollah and their anti-tank missiles. The difference between the two locations of the tribe of Dan is Samson's failure. Always keep that in mind. And so guys, what's the next tribe that is going to suffer at the hand of the Philistines? The tribe of Judah. But luckily, David comes along. And David makes sure that that would not happen again. Guys, this is the tomb of Samson. His tribe has to move. Ever since they move in that direction, the biblical borders of the land of Israel start at Dan to Beersheba. Conclusion, the phrase from Dan to Beersheba could not have been coming into being until after Samson's failure. Because until then, the tribe of Dan was not at the northern end, it was right in the middle. About a month ago, I had a small army and break from the army. And I decided that I didn't pay enough attention. I didn't give enough attention to my third child, Yarden. Had she been born in Israel, she would be called, in the US, she would be called Jordan. And so I took her to see the blossoming of the anemones here at a place called Tel Beth Shemesh. Behind you is the valley of Sorek, where Delilah was from. Up here is where Samson is buried. So this is, in fact, right here. And we go there, and she has a religious teacher, and she's interested in the Bible, and she comes to me and tells me, Daddy, what happened in this place? I open the Bible in 1 Samuel chapter 5, as Dr. Wave has taught me so many times, and I see that right there is where the Philistines sent the Ark of the Covenant to, after they took it in 1 Samuel chapter 4. It dawned on me right there that they decided to give it back after 7 months. This time, I don't even need to ask my barber. The Bible tells me that. A source a bit more credible, with all due respect to my barber, and I have a lot of respect to him. In any case, we see how Yarden likes the anemones, and she likes the Bible. And then I went further and researched the previous chapter, 1 Samuel chapter 4, in which the Philistines are growing stronger. They defeat us in the battle of Ibn Ezer. They actually take the Ark of the Covenant loot of war. They kill the two sons of Eli, the high priest. They raise Shiloh and its tabernacle to the ground. And Eli, the high priest, drops dead. We have no high priest, no tabernacle, no succession to the throne. The only thing we have left is Samuel himself. We were then divided, badly wounded, lying on the floor, bleeding, like the person in the Good Samaritan parable, if you remember. Of course you do. And so, what happens then is that the Ark of the Covenant is taken loot to Ashdod. And it gives the Philistines a lot of hard time. They are suffering plagues and all sorts of other issues. Then they move it to another Philistine city, thinking their jinx will be over. It doesn't. God wants to give them so much hard time. So they see their deities falling down, breaking into pieces. After 7 months, they give up, and they decide to simply give it back. They just send it on its way. It reaches Tel Beth Shemesh, and when it reaches Tel Beth Shemesh, eventually it will make its way to Kiryat Yearim, and will wait there until David would take Jerusalem and will move it to Jerusalem. So eventually it could be placed in Solomon's temple until the Babylonians, 400 years later, by 586 BC, will take the temple and destroy it and will do whatever to the Ark of the Covenant. Nobody knows the whereabouts of the Ark of the Covenant until 1981, when the movie Indiana Jones and the Raiders of the Lost Ark came out. And ever since then, it's in the warehouse of your army. Best movie ever. In any case, look at the similarities between the two different biblical events. We see Samson taken captive. It boomerangs on the Philistines. And according to my barber, it ends after 7 or 8 months. Then they take the Ark of the Covenant captive. It boomerangs on them, and they give it back after 7 months. It means that we see here how in biblical times, whatever they take from us captive boomerangs on them and ends after, give or take, 7 months. Comparing it to today's events in modern Israel, we see how they took 250 of us hostages. Look how it boomerangs on them. And let's hope that within 7 months, from October 7th, that all of this will be behind us. And that no later than the beginning of May, all the hostages will return. And we can have them back. But guys, I want to be so dead wrong. And I want the hostages back even earlier than that. Would you want to see Gil being wrong and the hostages to be back earlier than early May? I so hope to be wrong. I would take that theory and gladly smash it out the window just for their earlier return to their homeland. We have unpacked biblical events. But with your permission, let's move on to the next slide so we can see David. David has been around 3,000 years ago. He was born in a place called Bethlehem. By the way, in Hebrew, you have to pronounce the letters, the vowels, as if you're reading them in Spanish. So the A is an A sound. Therefore, his real name is David, which is what the inscription here actually says. It doesn't say David. Otherwise, you would have had another little fellow right here. So the fact it reads David is how you call him even today in Israel. Now, how do we know it's David? First, he's wearing a crown, he's playing the harp, and his name is well spelled. This is a mosaic floor found in the city of Gaza in archaeological excavations conducted by the Israeli Archaeological Antiquity Authority back in the 1980s when Gaza was still safe. They found it. Today, it's displayed in the Israel Museum. Conclusion. In the 6th century AD, there were Jews living in the Gaza Strip, having a synagogue of their own, 100 years before Islam would ever come into being. So even in Gaza itself, we are predating the Arabs by at least 100 years. But the most amazing prophecy, the most amazing quotation from the Bible will appear on our next slide. And that is something that I found almost by coincidence, thanks to a friend and a neighbor of mine called Amos. I'm sure you've heard about Amos. He actually lived at a place called Tekoa. And Tekoa is not far away from where I live. In fact, it's even closer to where I was serving up until 2 weeks ago. And when I read through Amos, I see one of the 22 references to the city of Gaza in the Bible. But this one is the most relevant to our discussion. Before we start, here is something I would like to share with you. Ever since the book of Genesis, Edom has always been the overarching name for whomever happened to be our enemy. 80 years ago, it was the Nazis. 2,000 years ago, it was the Romans. 2,600 years ago, the Babylonians. 2,400 years ago, the Persians. Okay, with Haman, who is about to be hanged on a tree a week from now, if you know what I mean. And so basically, we have here Edom, nowadays representing Iran. Boo. Let's read together. This is what the Lord says. For three sins of Gaza, even for four, I will not relent. Because she, Gaza, took captive whole communities and sold them to Edom. I will send fire on the walls of Gaza that will consume her fortresses. This is being fulfilled right before our eyes. This picture was taken 2 months ago. Gaza doesn't look any better by now. It actually looks a lot worse. Now we understood that there is a strong connection between biblical events in Gaza and modern events happening, unfolding right before our eyes. Let's move to the next slide so we can talk some modern history and connect it even more, even tighter. Allow me first to give you like a small timeline of modern events, which will bring us to how Gaza Strip even got to be created. In 1906, have you ever heard in history class the term Ottoman Empire? It's these Turks, right, who were controlling and dominating the Middle East for some 400 years. In 1906, they were already in the middle of their demise. So they are losing Egypt and the Sinai Peninsula next to Egypt to the British Empire. That's creating a borderline between the Mediterranean and the Red Sea that I will show you on our next slide and will be relevant for the understanding of the borders of the current Gaza Strip shortly. In World War I, the British are dismantling the Ottoman Empire, shredding it into as many pieces as possible so they can put the pieces back together into the countries that we see in the Middle East nowadays, Jordan, Syria, Iraq, Saudi Arabia, and even a country called Palestine. What's the name Palestine? Well, allow me first to tell you that the letter P does not exist in Arabic. In fact, when an Arab wants to pronounce the P, it comes out as a B. So if they do want to pronounce the P, they will tell you, I do know how to pronounce the P, but I don't know where to put it. Therefore, if they cannot pronounce the P, like Americans cannot pronounce the Ch, how can it be that the term Palestine would be a term in Arabic? It just cannot be the case. Guys, since the 2nd century AD, the Romans are coining the term Palestine as the name of our country, as the Western name of our country, to make it sound less Jewish and to rename that country after the bitter enemies of Israel from Old Testament times, the Philistines. Do you know that by the 2nd century AD, when the Romans do that, the Philistines are off the pages of history for some 700 years? So they are no longer an ethnic group. Now the Romans take their name and use it as a geographical name to describe a specific country, not a specific ethnicity. When that happens, it becomes the Western name of the geography called today's Israel. The British come as a big Western empire like the Romans, and they reintroduce that name after World War I, calling this country Palestine, without telling you that a Palestinian should be Jewish, Arab, Christian, and it was just a political definition of whomever lived there legally. I have news for you. Even the Nazis called that country Palestine. So in 1935, when they ordered my grandparents out of Germany, they told them, Jews, go to Palestine. So they did, on time. Otherwise, you would have had a different speaker here today, if you know what I mean. And so they went, and after their German citizenship has been revoked, they made it to Palestine. And the British gave them a Palestinian passport on behalf of the British Empire. Then my parents were born in 1944, 1945, in that same British mandate on Palestine. They have birth certificates to assert, to show you that they were born under the British mandate on Palestine. Their birth certificates were ratified by the British High Commissioner to Palestine and were issued in English, stating their nationality to be Palestinian. My parents, in case you had any doubt, are Jewish. and they are almost reaching 80 years of age. Let's wish them up to 120 like Moses. In any case, anybody living legally under the British Mandate on Palestine was considered a Palestinian, regardless of his religion, ethnicity, or language. Same like any person living in South Africa back then, under the British Empire, was referred to as a South African. In 1947, the British Empire shuts down. They are bankrupt after World War II. They have to shut down the empire. So they decide to call in the UN. So they will decide what to do with Palestine. The UN comes and offers to take one Palestinian state and make two Palestinian states out of it. One was going to be called a Jewish Palestinian state, a term which is in 1947 is not an oxymoron. The other state was going to be called an Arab Palestinian state. The Arabs said no to that UN resolution because they were good at two different things. One, to say no. They said no in 1922, 1929, 1937, 1947, 1967, 1987, 2000, and a few more times ever since. The other thing that they were always so good about is never to miss an opportunity. To miss an opportunity. They have been missing opportunities for over 100 years by now. And their situation is not getting any better, not even as we speak. In any case, their no triggered our war of independence, which would last 18 months. During these 8 months, we were first fighting local Arabs from within Palestine, and then fighting neighboring Arab countries which would invade Palestine or Israel starting 1948. Because on May 14, 1948, in the middle of that war of independence, the state of Israel was born, with David Ben-Gurion declaring our independence in Tel Aviv on May 14th, Friday afternoon at 4 p.m. Which country was the first country to acknowledge Israel's right to exist? If not your own country, it only took 11 minutes for Harry Truman to acknowledge and recognize the new Jewish state. Ever since then, the bondage between our countries is inseparable. And the flyers that you will later on get, they're on the table in the back, have the Israeli and the American flag together. They also have my picture, so feel free to hang me on your fridge. We are together. And yes, we have different opinions between us, like in every family. But at the end of the day, guys, Jews and Christians, Israelis and Americans are one big family. And as long as we stick to each other, nobody can defeat us. We just have to stick to each other. The love between the countries should be unconditional. Yes, we should ask questions. Yes, we should see how maybe we can do it better. But the love should be unconditional. Today, unfortunately, sometimes the love is conditional, not always unconditional, if you know what I mean. When the War of Independence was over in 1949, Israel and four Arab countries were signing armistice ceasefire agreements through the mediation of Ralph Bunche, the first African-American to serve in a high-ranking position in the United Nations. He won the Nobel Peace Prize for what he did in the year 1949. It was given to him in 1950. And then the borders of Israel were set according to where the troops were on the ground at that specific moment of April of 1949. When that happened, there were no terms called Gaza Strip or West Bank yet. There were no two different Palestinian states because one was renamed Israel, and my mom, at the age of 3, moved from being a Palestinian to being an Israeli. Do you think my mom has changed much at the age of 3? I don't think so. What did change was who was governing her life. It was no longer the British. It was now Israel itself. The other Palestinian state, that of the Arabs, was never created. Because the Arab countries, which took the territories allocated for the Palestinian state, never gave them their own statehood. Because the Arabs to this day don't help the Palestinians. 22 Arab countries who are not short on money at all and could do so much for the Palestinians are barely lifting a finger to help these Palestinians. What you also know is that two different refugee problems were created in 1949. Well, one I'm sure you've heard about because the news is telling you about it all the time. Of 700,000 Palestinians, Arabs, who were no longer in their homes when the war was over. Their problem remains unsolved after 75 years. I'm sure you've all heard from the media about that problem, but have you ever heard about the 900,000 Jews living in dozens of Arab countries who one clear day were evicted and expelled from these countries and were ordered to go and take nothing with them? Their property has been expropriated. Their money was left behind. They were told to leave and to never return. How come you never heard about the other refugee problem, that of the Jews? Because Israel would absorb these people and would make them Israeli citizens, thus allowing them to restart their lives despite the tragedy. The first problem remains unsolved, and soon you will know why. Soon you will know which kind of mechanism needs to disappear in order to solve the other problem. In the meantime, you see a hint of that. It's called UNRWA. More coming in one of the next slides. Let's move to the next slide so I can show you guys. First of all, the 1906 line. This line connected the Mediterranean with the Red Sea. Most of the line is irrelevant for our story, except the very end. That's the Gaza-Egypt border of today that you see on the news so many times. Have you ever heard about a city called Rafah? It's on the news all the time. Will Israel attack Rafah? Will Israel go to Rafah? Rafah is the city right here, right on that border. And so the Aqaba-Rafah line is from 1906, if you were ever wondering how that line even got to be created. When we move to the next slide, I can show you first and foremost the map in the middle. Remember how the UN wanted two Palestinian states instead of one? Creating the kickstart for the two-state no solution, as it was proposed for the first time in 1937, and for almost 100 years, was not successful. It means something. Maybe it's not the right solution. Maybe they need to come up with a different solution. So the two-state solution, I like to call it the two-state no solution, because it doesn't work for almost 90 years. In any case, this is the area allocated for the Jewish state. That was the area allocated for the Arab state. When the Arabs said no, the War of Independence began. And when the war was over, Israel was in control not only of the original blue area, but also of other areas originally allocated for the Arab state that are marked here in purple. The armistice treaties between Israel and Arab countries, be it the UN, ratified the position of the troops on the ground as the border, thus creating the blue and the purple combined as the internationally recognized borders of Israel starting 1949. The areas that were not under Israeli control were taken by two invading Arab countries that never had any right to any of these areas whatsoever and took these areas illegally. One country was called Jordan. They took an area west of the Jordan River and named it West Bank. Have you ever heard the term West Bank? It was occupied by Jordan before it was ever taken by Israel. The other area is a small strip of land around Gaza that the Egyptians never wanted to make it sound Egyptian in any way, shape, or form. So they kept the people there under martial law, didn't allow them any Egyptian civil rights, didn't allow them any Egyptian economic benefits, not even to study in Egypt. And to make that area not sound Egyptian at all, they named it with a name that will not make it sound Egyptian at all. Gaza Strip. A name that came into being almost by coincidence. And so if you had to summarize everything I told you and assess the situation starting 1949, it will be simplified with this map to your left. The next slide that I will show you is about what happened in the Gaza Strip since 1967. But before that, I would like to address a very important issue. Have you ever heard about UNRWA? What can you tell me about UNRWA? That they're corrupt. They have been around since 1950. Can you believe it? Does it say in the book of Genesis that all humans are created under the image of God? Why, therefore, are there two different UN refugee agencies? One, for all refugees worldwide, except Palestinian refugees. And another one, just for Palestinian refugees. Why would there be two of them? The first one, that deals with people who are refugees in Sudan, in Afghanistan, in Bosnia, in so many sad places worldwide, is where you can be a refugee only down to a certain generation. Let's say the grandson. After that, you will no longer be considered a refugee. You will no longer get a stipend from the UN. And you will no longer get money from the UN, which, oh, by the way, comes out of your taxpayer money, in case you were wondering. But at least people in that World Refugee Agency know that after a certain expiration date, that's it. They would have to restart their lives on their own. In the Palestinian Refugee Agency, the one whose logo you see right here, there is no statute of limitations. It means that you can be a refugee indefinitely. It means that they could be great-great-great-great-great-great-great-grandsons. And they would still get the status of a refugee. They would still collect stipends. They would still get money from the UN coming out of your taxpayer money. It means that as long as these people are considered refugees, they can just live off the stipends, what you have in the Gaza Strip. And everywhere there are Palestinian refugees is what's called international and generational welfare system. That keeps the Palestinians under a very low glass ceiling and doesn't allow them to have the incentive to restart their lives. That's why their problem has not been solved for 75 years. It's because of the very existence of UNRWA that their problem is not being solved. I honestly cannot understand why Palestinian refugees are any better or any worse than any other refugee worldwide. If all humans are created under the image of God, they should all be treated the same way. Guys, UNRWA needs to disappear off the pages of history completely. Now, hundreds of their workers were collaborating with Hamas and were, in fact, a Hamas organ. They were actively involved. Their phones were tracked in Israeli communities on October 7th, 2023. Hundreds of them were involved in the attack of October 7th. But before that, there was only one head of state from any state worldwide who understood that UNRWA was the problem. And his name was Donald Trump. Back in 2018, in the month of August, Donald Trump has declared the end of the U.S. financial aid to UNRWA. The budget of UNRWA is $1.1 billion every year. Donald Trump took out the whole U.S. aid to UNRWA, cutting it short by $400 million. Unfortunately, later on, it was resumed. And now it was cut again. I really hope that UNRWA will disappear. I'm going all over the U.S. and people come to me and even send me all sorts of messages. Why don't you so show sympathy to the Palestinians? And I tell them, guys, by eliminating UNRWA, we will show sympathy to the Palestinians because we will take out that glass ceiling that doesn't allow them to restart their lives. They will no longer be dependent upon their status of a refugee and hence the stipends. They will no longer be incentivized to have that many children to the extent that half the people in the Gaza Strip, 2.4 million people, of whom 1.2 million are under the age of 19. Why do you think this is happening? Because the more children, the more stipends, and the more they depend on UNRWA. UNRWA needs to disappear completely. Let's move on to the next slide. Until 1967, there was no hope in the Gaza Strip under Egypt. There was sand, tents, dust, no hope. A school here, hospital there, that's it. We came in 1967 and started giving the people there hope. We actually built new communities like those you see right here. We created new roads. We built them the very hospitals from which they are now attacking us. Even the underground areas of these hospitals were built according to the Israeli code of how you build a hospital. Now they are using these bunkers to fire at us, to put the hostages down there. Guys, they got from us so much hope upon our departure in 2005. When we pulled out of the Gaza Strip, we actually left all of that infrastructure behind for them to enjoy. We left them greenery, roads, hospitals, and greenhouses. And we also taught them how to work in agriculture, how to make their own lives. What they decided was something completely different. We even risked our own society by sending Israeli soldiers to evacuate Israeli civilians from their homes. We were willing to risk our society and almost get to the verge of a civil war in order to give the Palestinians of Gaza a new start, some hope. The next slide will show you what they did with that hope. They actually took the hope and made hopelessness out of it. If there was one picture summarizing all that has happened in the Gaza Strip over the past 20 years, it would be that picture. A 10-year-old boy carrying a loaded M16 machine gun. Guys, he is as indoctrinated to kill Jews, willing to die for that purpose, like everybody else around him. This has to stop. That picture was taken 10 years ago. He will be the one later on mutilating bodies in the kibbutzim 5 months ago. He may be the one raping women in these communities. He may have been the one who actually cut off people's heads or took Holocaust survivors as hostages. That has to end. We have to finish the leaders. We have to undo the indoctrination. We get the impressive results of what you guys did in places considered way more problematic, called Nazi Germany and Imperial Japan. You finished off their leaders, and eventually you allow these people to be unindoctrinated and to get a new start. Today, Germany and Japan are not such bad places to live in. And the people there have a totally different mentality than what they had in 1944. Therefore, we actually get so much hope at what your country did, even though it took decades, in places far bigger and far more problematic than the Gaza Strip, really not so long ago, only 80 years ago. And so the next slide will actually show us how do we go back to the Bible to find even more hope that this is possible. At the bottom, we can see Ruth. Have you ever heard about Ruth? Do you know that there's no TH in Hebrew? It should be actually just a T. So let's call her Ruth from now on, with your permission. Now, Ruth is a Moabite. The ancestry of the Moabite can be traced as early as Genesis 19, when Lot is in that cave with his daughters. And a few nights later, they conceive, and two nations come out of these two pregnancies. One is called Ammon, founding father of the Ammonites, whose capital city is still called Ammon, where I will take you guys one day if you behave. So far, you're so-so. The other nation is called Moab, not the one in Utah, the one in today's Jordan. And the starting point of the Moabites is very dubious. Their ancestry goes back to Lot and his daughters. Not a very good start if you think about it. Therefore, when Ruth is described as a Moabite, it means that she's starting from the very bottom, from one of the most incestuous stories in human history. But she finds Noemi and her family migrating from Bethlehem to the area of Moab in today's Jordan. It is right there that she finds a husband and marries not into that family, not just into that family, but also into the Jewish nation. Unfortunately, right at that moment, her father-in-law, husband, and brother-in-law all die. The other sister-in-law walks away. She turns her back on her new family and on her new nation. Ruth would never do such a thing. She sticks to her family, and she tells Naomi, "Wherever you go, I shall follow. I'm now part of your nation and part of your family." Guys, from the worst of circumstances, they're going to grow so much stronger. That's how we were like at the end of the book of Judges, because we were divided. We lost the battle to the Philistines. But later on, David comes along, and he's making us so much stronger. On October 7th, we were divided. We were wounded, but we're going to grow so much stronger out of that situation as well. 80 years ago, we were on the trains going to death camps. We grew out of that situation, the worst catastrophe that humanity has ever known. And now we have one of the best 15 economies in the world. We just grow stronger the more they try to annihilate us. This month in Judaism is the month of Adar. Adar is the month in which we celebrate the Feast of Purim. The Feast of Purim and the month of Adar is when we take our enemies' intentions and we turn it back on their own heads. And don't you ever forget that Haman was a Persian. Ladies and gentlemen, Ruth and Naomi are going back to the area of Bethlehem, right there in the field belonging to a gentleman called Boaz. Ruth falls in love with Boaz. Right there, one of the most beautiful love stories of the Bible is taking place. The community where I was serving up until 2 weeks ago is called the Field of Boaz. 3 generations after that love story, David is born to that same family. And he will be the one growing still in Bethlehem. And he will eventually be the one killing Goliath to make sure that his own tribe, Judah, would not suffer the same sad ending like the tribe of Dan. And so David will be the deliverer. He will be the one who will make us stronger out of that situation. Look how a situation which starts so hopeless ends up with so much hope. We have to always remember that out of each bad situation, when one door, even in life, when one door closes, 2 more doors open. And so we have to grow stronger out of the situation all the time. In fact, this was one of the most famous secrets of Judaism over the past 3,500 years, that we always knew to make ourselves stronger despite the circumstances. Now, if we move to the next slide, I can show you what it is that they did there. First, that place is really cold, 1,000 meters above sea level. So it's cold by Israeli standards. I was serving there at the peak of winter. It was really cold. And that place is where we were going sometimes, covering our whole body as if we were going skiing, and keeping nothing but the eyes, okay, exposed. But on my first patrol, it was a sunny day, and here's myself wearing uniform, carrying an M16 machine gun, having a vest, whatever. And I come across, on my first patrol, a sunny day, I come across a manger. Wait a second, I'm patrolling outside of Bethlehem, out in the field that may have belonged to Boaz, where Ruth and Boaz fell in love. And the first thing I come across in the winter is a manger in a field outside of Bethlehem. Sounds familiar? By the way, it was that cold. I don't know what these shepherds were doing there out at night. It was that cold in that area. In any case, that is what I come across. I found so much archaeology there. The people there told me, "Hey man, take some time off on the patrol. Why do you want to be on patrol all the time?" I told them, "Because so much archaeology here, I want to go know how to find it all." They told me, "You will need months from that. That's why I'm going back there, to find more archaeology and to protect Israel." And then I come across Shomerah, a tower in the middle of the vineyard. I see dozens of those. The Bible talks about them, but I don't remember where. I'm texting while I'm on patrol my good friend Dr. Wave Nunnally, and this redneck that I love so much is the one who is texting me back a whole page of nothing but biblical references over that specific tower and wherever it appears in the Bible. Thank you so much. I'm reading it to my guys in the unit, and they say, how do you know all of these things? And I tell them, I have a friend in Springfield, Missouri, of all places, who is the one revealing all of that to me. Thank you so much. And so when we move to the next slide, we can actually see what it is that we do. And the next slide is not this guy. We can actually play.